The guards might be persuaded to let him out by their own desire to be gone, if nothing else. If only Lawrence could persuade himself he had any right to go. But he had been court-martialed and convicted, and justly so, with all due process of law, though he would gladly have forgone it all. The endless dragging out of evidence, though he had been condemned already by his own voice, the panel of officers listening, faces blank if not tight with disgust. Navy officers, all of them, not an aviator had been allowed to serve. Too many of them had been one after another dragged into the vile business, implicated and smeared any way they could be. Ferris, because Lawrence must have confided in his first lieutenant. "And it must present a curious appearance to the court," the prosecutor had said, sneering, while Ferris sat, drawn and pale and wretched, and did not look at Lawrence, "that he did not raise the alarm for an hour after the accused and his beast were known to be missing, and did not at once open the letter which was left behind." Chenery, too, had been named, only because he had also been in London covert at the time, and Berkeley and Little and Sutton all brought in to give evidence, and if Harcourt and Jane had not been mentioned, Lawrence was sure it was only because the Admiralty did not know how to do it without embarrassing themselves more than their targets. "I did not know a damn thing about the business, and I'm sure neither did anyone else. Anyone who knows Lawrence will tell you he would not have breathed a word of it to anyone," Chenery had said defiantly. "But I do say sending over the sick beast was a blackguardly thing for the Admiralty to have done, and if you like to hang me for saying so, you are welcome." They had not hanged Chenery, thank God, for lack of evidence and for need of his dragon. But Ferris, a lieutenant with no such protection, had been broken out of the service. Every effort Lawrence had made to insist that the guilt was his alone had been ignored. A fine officer lost to the service, his career and his life spoilt. Lawrence had met his mother, his brothers. They were an old family and a proud, and Ferris had been away from home from the age of 7. They did not have that intimate personal knowledge which should make them confident of his innocence and give him the affectionate support now denied him from his fellow officers. To witness his misery and know himself culpable hurt Lawrence worse than his own conviction had done. That had never been in any doubt. There had been no defence to make, and no comfort but the arid certainty that he had done as he ought, that he could have done nothing else. That was no comfort at all, but that it saved him from the pain of regret. He could not regret what he had done. He could not have let 10,000 dragons, most of them wholly uninvolved in the war, be murdered for his nation's advantage. When he had said as much, and freely confessed that he had disobeyed his orders, assaulted a marine, stolen the cure and given aid and comfort to the enemy, there was nothing else to say. The only charge which he had contested was that he had stolen Temeraire too.
"He is neither the king's possession nor a dumb beast, and his choice was his own and freely made," Lawrence had said.
But he had been ignored, of course, and he had scarcely been taken from the room before he was brought back in again to hear his sentence of death pronounced. And then at once quietly postponed. He had been hurried from the chamber under guard and into a stifling black-draped carriage, a long, blind, rattling journey ended at Sheerness, where he had been put aboard the Lucinda, and then transferred to Goliath and put into the brig. An oubliette meant only to keep him breathing and little else. A living death, worse than the hanging he was promised in future, and if he stayed and was not taken by the French, they would only put him back into an upright coffin. Lawrence knew it well. But that was not his choice to make. He had made one choice, and sacrificed all the others. His life was no longer his own, even if the court chose to leave it to him a little while longer, and to flee now would be no better than to have fled to China, or to have accepted Napoleon's offers and solicitations to stay. He could not go. He had no other way of knowing himself not a traitor, no other reparation he could make. He might look at the door, but he could not open it. A brief glaze of rain washed the window and thinned the smoke outside. He went to stand by the window, though he could not see anything but a general grey dimness. The sun, if it had come up, stayed hidden. He rather felt than knew it was past dawn. The knob rattled in the door, and the door opened. Lawrence turned and stopped, staring at the man on the other side, the familiar but unexpected lean face, travel-leathered, and the oriental features. "I hope I find you in good health," Tharkay said. "Will you come with me? I believe there is still a danger of fire."
The guards had vanished. The house was entirely deserted, but for a couple of men who had wandered in drunk off the street and were sleeping in the front hall. Lawrence stepped over their legs and out into the morning, a thin, pallid haze of smoke and false dawn lying over the docks and drifting out to sea. Glass and broken slate and charred wood littered the street, and unspeakable trash. A couple of sweepers lugubriously pushed their brooms down the middle of the lane, doing not very much to help. Tharkay led Lawrence down a side alley, where the dead body of a horse, stripped of saddle and bridle, lay blocking the way. A young kestrel, with long trailing jesses, perched on its side, tearing occasionally at the flesh and uttering a satisfied cry. Tharkay held out his hand and whistled, and the kestrel came back to him, to be hooded and secured upon his shoulder.
"I am 3 weeks back from the Pamirs," Tharkay said. "I brought another dozen feral beasts for your ranks. In good time, it seems. Roland sent me to bring you in." "But how came you here?"
Lawrence said, while they picked their way onwards through the unfashionable back streets. The town looked very much as though it had been already sacked, and those windows and doors yet intact were all shut tight, some boarded, giving the house fronts an unfriendly, glowering air.
"How you knew I was in town?" "The town was not the difficulty. The wreckers off the coast knew which way the Goliath's boats had gone," Tharkay said. "I was here before you were, I imagine. Finding where you had been stowed was more difficult. I foolishly went to the trouble to get these first," showing Lawrence a folded pack of papers, "from the Port Admiral, in the assumption he would know the whereabouts of the prisoner he was assigning to me, but he left me in the hall 2 hours and quarrelled with me another, and only when I had his signature did he at last confess to having not the least knowledge where you were with the harbour on fire."
They came to a bare clearing, a courier covert where little Gurney waited for them, fidgeting anxiously. She hissed at Tharkay urgently. He answered her in the same tangled dragon language which Lawrence could not make much sense of, and then clambered up her scanty rigging to her back, pointing Lawrence at the couple of handholds to get himself aboard.
"We may have some difficulty," Tharkay said. "Bonaparte's men are still nearly all on the coast, but his dragons are going deep inland." 50,000, I believe," he answered, when Lawrence asked how many men. "And as many as 200 beasts, if one cares to believe the figure. The corps has fallen back with the rest of the army to Woolwich, I believe to await Bonaparte's pleasure. Why they are being so courteous, you would have to ask the generals."
"I thank you for coming," Lawrence said.
Tharkay had risked a great deal with such geography. Half Bonaparte's army landed somewhere between them and the army.
"You have taken service, then?"
he asked, looking at Tharkay's coat. He wore gold bars, a captain's rank. It was not uncommon in the army for a man to be commissioned when he was needed, if a rarer phenomenon in the corps, where the dragon made the rank, than in other branches. But with Tharkay one of the few who could speak with the feral dragons of the Pamirs, it was no surprise the corps had wanted him. More of one that he had accepted.
"For now," Tharkay shrugged.
"No one could accuse you of an interested choice," Lawrence said,
too grim for even black humour, with a smell of the burning city in his nostrils.
"One of its advantages," Tharkay said. "Any fool could throw in his lot with a victor."
Lawrence did not ask why he had been sent. 50,000 men landed was answer enough. Temeraire must be wanted, and Lawrence himself the only, however undesirable, means to come by his services. It was a pragmatic and a temporary choice only, nothing to give him hope of forgiveness, either personal or legal. Tharkay himself volunteered no more. Gurney was already springing aloft, and the vigour of the wind blew all possible words away. The sky had the peculiar late-autumn crispness, very blue and clear and cloudless, beautiful flying weather, and they had scarcely been half an hour aloft before Gurney suddenly plunged beneath them, and trembling went to ground in a wooded clearing of pines. Lawrence had seen nothing, except perhaps a few specks drifting that might have been wandering birds, but he and Tharkay pushed forward to the edge of the woods, and peering out from the shade saw at length two shapes leap up from the ground and come closer. Two big, grey and brown dragons, gliding with lazy assurance. And well they might. Grand Chevaliers, the largest of the French heavyweights, only a little smaller than regal coppers. They were messy with recent pillaging, and each had what looked like a dozen cows dangling, stupefied, in their belly netting, these occasionally uttering groggy and perplexed moans and pawing ineffectually at the air with their hooves. The pair went by, calling to each other cheerfully in French, too colloquial and rapid for Lawrence to follow, their crews laughing. Their shadows passed like scudding clouds, a moment's complete blotting of the sun while Gurney held very still beneath the branches. Her eyes were the only part of her which moved, tracking the great dragon's passage overhead. She could not be persuaded back aloft afterwards, but curled up as deeply as she could wedge herself into the trees, and proposed instead that they should bring her something to eat. She would not go again until it was dark. That the French fleur de nuits would be out then, in their turn, was not an argument which Lawrence wished very much to attempt on her, for fear of her refusing to go on at all. Tharkay only shrugged and examined his pistols, and put himself on a track towards the nearby farmhouses.
"Perhaps the chevaliers will not have eaten all the cattle."
There were no cows left visible, nor sheep, nor people, only a scattering of unhappy chickens which Tharkay methodically loosed the kestrel against one after another. They would not make much dinner for Gurney, but a little was better than nothing. And then in the stable a small pig was discovered, rooting unconcernedly in the straw, oblivious both to the fate which it had earlier escaped and to the one which now descended upon it. Gurney was neither picky nor patient enough to demand her pork cooked, and they roasted the chickens for themselves over a small, well-banked fire, feeding the kestrel on the sweetbreads and waving their hands through the smoke to thin it out. Without salt, the meat had little flavour, but did well enough to fill their stomachs. They gnawed it down to the bones, and buried the remnants deep. They rubbed their greasy hands clean with grass. And then only the wait for the sun to go down, a crawling time when it was scarcely yet noon, and the ground cold and hard to sit upon. Wet, rotting leaves in a muck everywhere, the wind blowing a steady chill into fingers and feet with all the stamping they could do. But Lawrence could stand when he chose and go to the edge of the copse and feel the wind blowing freely into his face, and see the placid, well-ruled fields in their orderly brown ranks, and tall white birch trees raising their limbs high against the unbroken sky. Tharkay came and stood beside him. There was no alteration in his looks or manner. If he was silent, he had been silent before. It was to Lawrence as much liberation as the absence of locks and barred doors to be able to stand here a moment and be no traitor, but only himself, unchanged, in the company of another. He had suffered wide disapproval before, without intolerable pain, when he knew himself in the right. He had not known it could be so heavy. Tharkay said,
"I might never have found you, of course."
It was an offer, and Lawrence was ashamed to be tempted. Tempted so strongly, he could not immediately make his refusal, not with all freedom open before him, and the stench of smoke and the ship's bilges still thick in the back of his throat, ready to be tasted.
"My idea of duty is not yours," Tharkay said, "but I know of no reason why you owe it to any man to die to no purpose."
"Honour is sufficient purpose," Lawrence said, low.
"Very well," Tharkay said. "If your death would preserve it better than your life. But the world is not yet quite ranged all between Britain and Napoleon, and you do not need to choose between them or die. You would be welcome, and temeraire, in other parts of the world. You may recall there is at least a semblance of civilization," he added dryly, "in some few places beyond the borders of England."
"I do not," Lawrence said, struggling. "I will not pretend that I do not consider it, for Temeraire's sake, if not my own. But to fly would be to make myself truly a traitor."
"Lawrence," Tharkay said after a pause, "you are a traitor."
It was a blow to hear him say so, in his cool, blunt way, all the lack of passion in the words serving only to make them seem less accusation than statement of fact.
"Allowing them to put you to death for it may be a form of apology, but it does not make you less guilty."
Lawrence did not know how to answer. Of course Tharkay was right. It was useless to cry that he loved his country and had betrayed her only in extremis, as the lesser of two hideous evils. He had betrayed her, and the cause mattered not at all. So perhaps for nothing now he condemned Temeraire to lonely servitude, himself to lifelong imprisonment. Perhaps all that could be lost had been lost. And yet, he could not answer. They stood a long while, mutely. At last Tharkay shook his head and put his hand on Lawrence's shoulder.
"It is getting dark."
"Yes, I sent for him," Jane said flatly. "And you may leave off your coughing and your insinuations. If I wanted a man between my legs so badly, there is a campful of handsome young fellows outside, and I dare say I could find one out to oblige me without going to such trouble." Having momentarily appalled her audience of generals and ministers into silence, she rode on with no more muttering to contend against. If the French took him prisoner, they would have two Celestials, and even if the two are too close related to breed direct, they will cross-breed them, perhaps to Grand Chevaliers, if you like to imagine that, and breed the offspring back to fix the traits. In a generation they will have a breed of their own, and we nothing. We haven't a single egg out of Temeraire yet. Put Lawrence in a jail wagon and bring him along under guard if you insist, but if you have any sense you will make use of him and the beast." The atmosphere in the general's tent was not a convivial one. All conversation circled endlessly around the central disaster of the landing, returning to it again and again, and Lawrence had already gathered enough to understand. Jane had not been in command of the aerial defence after all. Sanderson had been made admiral at Dover over her head. For what reason, Lawrence scarcely needed to wonder. They had never liked making her commander. But having been forced to do it by necessity, they would likely have gone on as they had begun, rather than admit a mistake, if they had not wanted vengeance, if they had not thought her complicit in Lawrence's treason. As for Sanderson, Lawrence knew the man a little. He was handler to a Parnassian, and commanded a large independent formation at Dover. They had served together, if not very closely. Thoroughly experienced, but no brilliant officer, Lawrence would have said, and Sanderson's attention was badly divided. Though his animosia had been dosed with the cure several times, she still fared poorly from the after-effects of the epidemic, and it had nearly killed him, too. He was not a year short of 60, and had scarcely slept or eaten while his dragon ailed. He sat now in a corner of the tent and wiped occasionally at an oozing cut over his eye with a folded bandage, saying nothing, while the generals shouted instead at Jane. He looked grey and faded under the bright, bloody streak on his forehead.
"Splendid. So you would put a known traitor and his uncontrollable beast into the middle of our very lines," one member of the Navy Board said. "You may as well rig up a telegraph and signal all our plans to Bonaparte at once."
"Bonaparte can't damn well have an easier time of it than he has already, unless you run up a white flag instead," Jane snapped. "He has 100 dragons more than he ought to by any numbers. You gentlemen at the Admiralty swear up and down we should have heard if he'd stripped Prussia and Italy to the bone, so I suppose he's pulling them out of the trees. And as we can't do the same, we must have every last beast we can scrounge. 6 beasts too injured to fight in the next month, 4 of our newest ferals slunk off, and you want to let a Celestial rot? Pure idiocy!"
"Why precisely are we listening to this haranguing fishwife?"
someone said.
"To be precise," Jane said, "you aren't listening to me, and you had better start. Begging your pardon, Sanderson, you are a damned fine formation leader, but you weren't the man for this."
"No, not at all, Roland,"
Sanderson said dully, and patted the cloth to his forehead again.
"We are listening to her," another general said in back, impatient, a lean, sharp-faced man with a decided aquiline nose and the Order of the Bath. "Because you could not scrape up a competent man for the job. We are not going to beat Bonaparte with yesterday's mess."
"Portland,"
another began.
"Stop bleating the man's name like a talisman," the general said. "If it is not Nelson with you, it is Portland. Gibraltar is as bad as Denmark. Neither of them is to be had in under a month. Until then, get out of her way."
"'General Wellesley, you cannot seriously be lending your voice to the suggestion,'
another minister said, gesturing to Lawrence.
"'Thank you! I am capable of deciding to what I will lend my voice without consultation,' Wellesley said.
He raked Lawrence up and down with a cold, dismissive eye.
"'He is a sentimentalist, isn't he? Surrendered himself? Damned romantic! What difference does it make? Hang him after!'
Jane took him to her tent. "'No, you had better stay, Fred,' she said, speaking to her aide-de-camp, who had risen from a camp table as she ducked inside. "'I can better afford to be frank before a witness than make hay for any more rumours.' She poured herself a glass of wine and drank it with her back to him. Lawrence could not quarrel with her decision, but he wished that they had been alone. He himself felt it impossible to speak as he wished before anyone else. Then she put down the glass and sat down behind her desk.
"'Tomorrow you will go by courier to Penavan,' she said tiredly, without looking at him. "'That is where they have been keeping Temeraire. "'Will you bring him back?'
"'Yes, of course,'
Lawrence said.
"'They very likely will hang you after, unless you manage to do something heroic,' Jane said.
"'If I had wished to avoid justice, I might have stayed in France,' Lawrence said.
"'Jane!' "'Admiral Roland, if you please,' she said sharply.
After a moment's silence, she added,
"'I cannot blame you, Lawrence. Christ knows it was ugly. But if I'm to do any good, I cannot be fighting their damned lordships as well as Napoleon's dragons. Fret will take you to the officer's tent to eat and find you somewhere to sleep. You will go tomorrow, and when you come back, you will be flying in formation under Admiral Saunders, and that will be all.'
She gave a jerk of her head, and Fret, clearing his throat, held open the tent flap. Lawrence could only bow and withdraw too slowly, wishing he had not seen her drop her forehead to her clenched fist and the grimness around her mouth. There was a dreadful awkwardness when he came into the large mess tent in Fret's company. He saw none of his nearest acquaintance, and was glad to postpone that evil, but several remarks were made by captains little known to him which he had to pretend not to hear. And worse than that was the discomfort and downcast faces of those who would not snub him, but still did not choose to meet his eyes. He had been prepared for this much. He was not as well braced to have his hand seized and aggressively pumped by a gentleman he had only seen perhaps twice before across the officers' common room at Dover. Captain Hesterfield loudly said, "'May I shake your hand, sir?' Too late for the request to be refused. And then, nearly bodily, dragged Lawrence over to his table in the corner, and presented him to his companions. There were six officers at the small and huddled table, two Prussians, one of whom von Pfeil Lawrence recognised from the siege of Danzig, and another who stood and shook his hand, and introduced himself as cousin to Captain Dyhern, with whom they had fought at the Battle of Jena. They were refugees from their own country, having chosen exile and service in Britain over accepting the parole which Napoleon had offered to Prussian officers. Another stranger, Captain Pruett, had been called to England a few months before out of desperation. His Winchester had escaped the epidemic, as they were ordinarily assigned to Halifax Covert, whence he had been stationed on a lonely circuit out in Quebec to put him out of the way of anyone hearing his radical political views, as he freely acknowledged.
"'Or perhaps my poetry,' Pruett said, laughing at himself. "'But my pride can better stand condemnation of my politics than of my art, so I choose to take it so. And this is Captain Latour,'
a French royalist turned British officer. Hesterfield and the two others, Reynolds and Gounod, were political sympathisers of Pruett's, if a little quieter than he on the subject, and Lawrence gradually realised they were not incidentally supporters of his act, but were divided from the rest of the company precisely by quarrelling over it.
"'Murder! Murder most foul! There is no other word!' Reynolds declared,
covering Lawrence's hand with his own, pinning it to the table by the wrist, and looking at him with a focused, too earnest expression of the profoundly drunk. Lawrence did not know what to say. He had agreed, and had laid down his life to prevent it, but he did not care to be congratulated for it by a stranger.
"'Treason is another word, if you like,' another officer said at the nearest populated table, making no pretences about eavesdropping. A bottle of whisky, half empty, stood before him, and he was drinking alone. "'Hear, hear,' another man said.
there were entirely too many bottles in the room, and too many angry and disappointed men. It was an invitation for a scene. Lawrence disengaged his hand. He would heartily have liked to excuse himself and shift tables, but Fret had abandoned him to Pruitt and his willing company, and Lawrence could not imagine imposing himself on anyone else in the room.
"I beg you, gentlemen, not to speak of it," he said quietly to the table.
To no avail. Reynolds was already arguing with the whiskey drinker, and their voices were penetrating. Lawrence set his jaw and tried not to hear.
"And I say," the whiskey drinker was saying, "that he is a traitor who ought to be drug outside, strung up and drawn and quartered after, and you with him, if you say otherwise."
"Medieval sentiment!"
They were both standing now, Reynolds shaking off Gounod's half-hearted restraining hand to get up. Their voices had risen enough to drown all nearby conversation. Lawrence rose and, catching Reynolds by the shoulder firmly, pressed him back towards his chair.
"Sir, you do me no kindness by this. Leave off," he said, low and sharply.
"That's right. Let him teach you how to be a coward," the other man said.
Lawrence stiffened. He could not resent insults which he had earned. He had sacrificed the right to defend himself against traitor. But coward was a slap he could not gladly swallow. Yet even if dueling were not forbidden aviators, he could not make challenge. He had caused enough harm. He could not, would not, do more. He closed his mouth on the bitterness in the back of his throat and did not turn to look the man in the face, though he stood now so offensively close his liquored breath came hot and strongly over Lawrence's shoulder.
"Call him a coward when you would have sat and done nothing?"
Reynolds flung back, resisting the push. He shook off Lawrence's hand, or tried.
"I suppose your dragon would think a lot of your being happy to see 10,000 of them put down, poisoned or good as, like dogs?" "At least one of them ought to be poisoned," the other man said.
And Lawrence let go of Reynolds and turned and knocked him down. The man was drunk and unsteady, and going down pulled the table and the bottle over with him, cheap liquor bubbling out over the dirt as it rolled away. For a moment no one spoke, and then chairs went back across the tent eagerly, as if nothing more had been wanted than a pretext. The quarrel at once devolved into a confused melee, with nothing so organized as sides. Lawrence saw two men from the same table wrestling in a corner, but a few men singled him out, one a captain he knew by face from Dover, if not immediately by name. He had streaks of black dragon blood fresh on his clothing. Geoffrey Windle, Lawrence remembered incongruously as they grappled, and then Windle struck him full on the jaw. The impact rocked him back on his heels. His teeth snapped together, jarring all up to his skull with the startling pain of a bitten cheek. Gripping a tent pole for purchase, Lawrence managed to seize a chair and pull it around between them as Windle lunged at him again. The man tripped over it and went into the pole with his full weight, considerable as he had some 3 stone over Lawrence. The canvas roof above sagged precipitously. 2 more men came at Lawrence, faces ugly with anger, and caught him by the arms together to rush him against the nearest table. Drunk enough to be belligerent, not enough to be clumsy. He still had on his buckled shoes and his laddered stockings, and neither good purchase on the ground, nor the weight of his boots to kick out with. They pinned him down, and one had out a knife, a dull eating knife still slick with grease from his dinner. Lawrence set his heel down against the surface of the table and heaved, managing to get his shoulders loose a moment, twisting away from the short, furious stabbing of the blade, so it only tore into his ragged coat. The tent pole creaked and gave, and the canvas came pouring down upon them in a sudden catastrophic rush. His arms were free, only to be imprisoned worse in the smothering folds, so heavy he had an effort to lift it clear enough from his face to breathe. He rolled off the table, and then there were hands gripping his arm again, pulling at him. Lawrence struck out blindly at the new attacker, and they went falling together, rolling along the dirt floor, until the other man managed to drag the edge of the canvas off their heads and get them into the open air. It was Granby.
"Oh, Lord!"
Granby said. Lawrence turned and saw half the tent crumpled in on a heaving mass beneath. Those sober enough to have avoided the fighting were carrying out the lanterns from the other side, and others dousing the collapsed canvas with water. Some smoke trickled out from beneath.
"You'll do a damn sight more good to come out of the way here,"
Granby said, when Lawrence would have gone to help, and drew him along one of the camp paths, narrow and stumbling dark, towards the dragon clearings. They walked in silence over the uneven ground. Lawrence tried to slow his short, clenched breathing without success. He felt inexpressibly naive. He had not even thought to fear such a possibility until he heard it in the mouth of a drunkard. But when they did hang him, knowing it would lose them Temeraire's use, what might not those same men do who had meant to infect all the world's dragons with consumption and condemn them to an agonized death? Of course, they would gladly see Temeraire dead, rather than of use to anyone they were disposed to see as an enemy, France or China or any other nation. They would not scruple at any sort of treachery necessary to achieve his destruction. To them, Temeraire was only an inconvenient animal.
"I suppose," Granby said abruptly out of the dark, "that he insisted on it? You're carrying the stuff to France, I mean."
"He did,"
Lawrence said after a moment, but he did not mean to hide behind Temeraire's wings.
"I'm ashamed to say he was forced to at first. I am ashamed of it. I would not have you believe I was taken against my will."
"No,"
Granby said.
"No, I only meant you shouldn't have thought of it at all on your own."
The observation felt true, and uncomfortably so, though Lawrence supposed Granby had meant it as consolation. A sudden, sharp stab of feeling caught his breath. Loneliness, and something more, an inarticulate next cousin to homesickness. He wanted very badly to see Temeraire. Lawrence had slept his last night beneath the sheltering wing nearly 3 months ago, in the northern mountains, treason already committed and a few hours snatched before they made the fatal flight across the channel. Since then there had been only a succession of prisons, more or less brutal, for them both. And what had these months been for Temeraire, alone and friendless and unhappy, in the breeding grounds full of feral beasts and veterans, with likely no order or discipline to keep them from fighting? They fell into silence again, passing the clearings one by one. The mill house rumble of sleeping dragons to either side, their own dinners finished, and their crews toiling on the harnesses with only a few lanterns, the faint clanking of the smith's hammers tapping away, and the acrid, smoky stink of harness oil. They had a long walk out in the dark, after the last clearing, climbing a steep slope upwards to the crown of a hill, prominently placed overlooking all the camp, where Iskierka lay sleeping in a thick, spiny coil, steam issuing with every breath, and the feral dragons scattered around her. She cracked an eye open as they came in and inquired drowsily, "Is it a battle yet?"
"No, love, back to sleep,"
Granby said, as she sighed and shut her eye. But she had drawn the notice of the men. They looked up, and then they looked from Lawrence to Granby, and then they looked back down again, saying nothing.
"Perhaps I had best not stay,"
Lawrence said. He knew some of the faces, men from his own crew, some of his former officers. He was glad they had found places here.
"Stuff,"
Granby said.
"I'm not so damned craven. And anyway,"
he added more despondently when he had led Lawrence into his own tent, pitched in the comfortable current of heat which Iskierka gave steadily off,
"I cannot be much farther in the soup than I am already after yesterday. She's spoiled, there is no other word for it. Wouldn't keep information, wouldn't obey signals. Took the ferals with her."
He shrugged, and taking up his own private bottle from the floor, poured them each a glass, which he drank with an unaccustomed enthusiasm.
"It's not so bad on patrol,"
Granby said, wiping his mouth after.
"She doesn't need any coaxing to look out the enemy. And she'll take directions to make it easier. I hardly notice any more. But in a fleet action, I don't mean she was useless,"
he added with a defensive note.
"Did for a first-rate and 3 frigates, all herself and those fellows, and chased 12 French beasts. But she hasn't a shred of discipline. Pretended not to hear me. Left the right wing of the corps wide open and 2 beasts badly hurt for it. I ought to be broken for it, if they could afford to give her up."
He was pacing the small confines of the tent, still holding the empty glass and talking swiftly, almost nervously, more to be saying something, filling the air between them than the particular words.
"This is the sort of thing that rots the corps," he said. "I never thought I would be a bad officer, Someone who ruins his dragon. Some other kind of fool, kept on because his beast won't serve otherwise. The army, the navy, they sneer at us for that, as much as for anything else. And there, at least, they're right to sneer. So our admirals have to dance to the navy's tune, and meanwhile the youngsters see it too, and you can't ask them to be better when they see a fellow let off anything, anything at all.
He pulled himself up abruptly, realizing too late that his words were applicable to more of his audience than himself, and looked at Lawrence miserably.
"You are not wrong," Lawrence said.
He had assumed as much himself, after all, in his navy days, had thought the corps full of wild, devil-may-care libertines, disregarding law and authority as far as they dared, barely kept in check, to be used for their control over the beasts and not respected.
"But if we have more liberty than we ought," Lawrence said after a moment, struggling through, "it is because they have not enough. The dragons, they have no stake in victory but our happiness. Their daily bread any nation would give them just to have peace and quiet. We are given license so long as we do what we ought not, so long as we use their affections to keep them obedient and quiet, to ends which serve them not at all, or which harm.
How else do you make them care?"
Granby said.
"If we left off, the French will only run right over us and take our eggs themselves."
"They care in China," Lawrence said, "and in Africa, and care all the more that their rational sense is not imposed on, and their hearts put into opposition with their minds. If they cannot be woken to a natural affection for their country such as we feel, it is our fault, and not theirs."
Lawrence slept the night in Granby's tent, atop a blanket. He would not take Granby's cot. It was odd to sleep hot and wake in a midsummer sweat, then step out and see the camp below dusted overnight with snow, soiled grey tents for the moment clean white, and the ground already churning into muddy slush.
"You are back,"
Iskierka said, looking at Lawrence. She was wide awake, picking over the charred remnants of her breakfast, and watching the sluggish camp with a disgruntled eye.
"Where is Temeraire? He has let you get into a wretched state," she added, with rather a smug air.
Lawrence could not argue. He was a pitiful sight indeed, in raggedy coat and his shoes beginning to open at the seams, and the less said of his stockings the better.
"Granby," she said, looking over his shoulder, "you may lend Lawrence your fourth best coat, and then you may tell Temeraire," she added to Lawrence, "that I'm very sorry he cannot give you nicer things."
However, Granby was wearing his fourth best coat, as the other three were so adorned with gold braid and jewels, the fruits of Iskierka's determined prize-hunting, as to be wholly unsuitable for actual fighting. It would not in any case have been a very successful loan, as Lawrence had some 4 inches in the shoulders which Granby had instead in height. But Granby sent word out, and shortly a young runner came back carrying a folded coat and a spare pair of boots.
"Why, Sifo," Lawrence said, "I'm glad to find you well. And your brother, I hope?"
It worried what might have become of the two boys brought from Africa who had so helped them there. He had made them his own runners briefly by way of providing for them, but he had too shortly thereafter put himself in no position to be of assistance to anyone.
"Yes, sir,"
Sifo said in English, as perfect as Lawrence had ever heard in his life, though less than a year before the child had never heard a word of it.
"He is with Arcady, and Captain Berkeley says you are welcome to these, and to come and say hello to Maximus, would you, if you are not too damned stiff-necked. He said to say just that," he added earnestly.
"You aren't the only one who owes them,"
Berkeley said in his blunt way, when Lawrence had come and thanked him for assuming the responsibility.
"You needn't worry about them being cast off, anyway. We need them. They can jaw with those damned ferals better than any man jackos. That older boy talks their jabber quicker than he does English. You can worry about their getting knocked on the head instead. I had a fight on my hands to make the Admiralty let me keep this one grounded for now. They would have put him up as an ensign, if you like. Not 9 years of age. Domain they would have no matter what I said, but that is just as well. Fight,"
he added succinctly.
"So they may as well do it against the frogs, when it don't get him in hot water."
Maximus was much recovered from the last Lawrence had seen him. 3 months of steady feeding on shore had brought him nearly up to his former fighting weight, and he put his head down and said in a conspiratorial whisper,
"Tell Temeraire that Lily and I have not forgotten our promise, and we are ready to fight with him whenever he should ask.
We will not let them hang you at all."
Lawrence stared up at the immense, regal copper. All his crew looked deeply distressed, as well they might, the outlaw remark being perfectly audible several clearings over. Berkeley only snorted.
"There's been plenty of talk like that, and louder," he said. "I expect that's why you've been kept stuffed between decks in a ship instead of a decent prison on land. No, don't beg my pardon. It was sure a sixpence you and that mad beast of yours would make a spectacle of yourselves soon or late. Bring him back, do for a dozen frogs, and save us all the bother of the execution."
With this sanguine, if unlikely, recommendation, Lawrence reported to the courier clearing with his orders, looking a little less shabby. Berkeley was a thick-set man, but if the borrowed coat was too large, at least it could be got on, and with a little padding of straw at the toes, the boots were entirely serviceable. His repaired appearance got him no better treatment, however. There were a dozen beasts waiting for messages and orders, but when Lawrence had presented himself, the courier master said, "If you'll be so good as to wait," and left him outside the clearing. Lawrence was near enough to see the master talking with his officers. None of the courier captains looked very inclined to take him up. He was left standing an hour while four messages came in and were sent out, before another Winchester landed bringing fresh orders from the Admiralty, and at last the courier master came and said, "Very well, we have a man to take you."
"Morning, sir,"
the captain said, touching his hat as Lawrence came over. Hollin, his former ground crew master.
"Elsie, will you give the captain a leg up? There is a strap there, sir, handy for you."
"Thank you, Hollin,"
Lawrence said, grateful for the steady matter-of-factness, and climbed up to her back.
"We are for Penny Van."
"Right you are, sir. We know the way,"
Hollin said.
"Do you need a bite to sup, Elsie, before we go?"
"No," she said, raising her head, dripping from the water-trough. "They always have lovely cows there. I will wait."
They did not speak very much during the flight. Winchesters were so small and quick, one felt always on the point of flying off on one's own, the force of the wind steadily testing the limits of the carabiner straps, and Lawrence's hands, already blistered, grew bruised where he held on to the leather harness. They raced past blurring fields of brown stalks and snow, the thin, cold air chapping at their faces and leaking down into the neck of Lawrence's coat, through the threadbare shirt and piercing to the skin. He did not mind in the least, except to wish they might go quicker still. He resented now every mile remaining. Goodrich Castle swelled up before them on its hill, and Hollin put out the signal flags as they flashed by, courier with orders, and the fort's signal gun fired in acknowledgement, already falling behind them. The mountains were growing nearer and nearer, and as the sun began to set, Elsie came over the final sharp ridge and over the broad packed-earth feeding grounds, stained dark with much blood, and the cliffs full of dragon holes. She landed. The cattle pen was empty, its wide door standing open. There were no lights and no sound. There was not a dragon anywhere to be seen. Chapter 4. Overnight, icicles had grown upon the overhang of the cave, a row of glittering teeth, and now as the sun struck, they steadily dripped themselves away upon the stone, an uneven pattering without rhythm or sense. Temeraire opened his eyes once in a while, dully to watch them shrink back away towards the edge. Then he closed his eyes and put his head down. No one had further proposed his removal or disturbed him. A scrabbling of claws made him look up. A small dragon had landed on the ledge, and Lloyd was sliding down from its back.
"Come now, then," Lloyd said, tramping in, his boots ringing and smearing field muck on the clean stone. "Come now, old boy. Why such a fuss today? We have a lovely visitor waiting. A nice fat bullock will set you up."
Temeraire had never very much wanted to kill anyone, except, of course, anyone who tried to hurt Lawrence. He liked to fight well enough, as it was exciting, but he had never thought that he would like to kill anyone just for himself. Only, in this moment, it seemed to him he would much rather anything than have Lloyd before him speaking so when Lawrence was dead.
"Be silent," he said,
and when Lloyd continued, without a pause,
"The very best put aside for you special to-night.
Temeraire stretched out his neck and put his head directly before Lloyd and said, low,
"My captain is dead."
That at least meant something to Lloyd. He went white and stopped talking. He held himself very still. Temeraire watched him closely. It was almost disappointing. If only Lloyd would say something else dreadful, or do something foul as he always did. If only... But Lawrence would not like it. Lawrence would not have liked it. Temeraire drew in a long hissing breath, and drew his head back, curling in upon himself again, and Lloyd sagged in relief.
"Why, there's been some mistake," he said after a moment,
his voice only a few shades less hearty.
"I've heard nothing, old boy. Word would have been sent me."
It made Temeraire angry all over again, but differently. That sharp, strange feeling was dulled, and now he felt quite tired, and wished only for Lloyd to be gone away.
"I dare say you would tell me he were alive if he had been hanged at Tyburn," he said bitterly. "Only as long as it made me eat, and mate, and listen to you. Well, I will not. I have borne it. I would have borne anything, only to keep Lawrence alive. I will bear it no longer. I will eat when I like and not otherwise, and I will not mate with anyone unless I choose."
He looked at the little dragon who had brought Lloyd up, and said,
"Now take him away, if you please, and tell the others I do not want him brought again without asking first."
The little dragon bobbed his head nervously and picked up the startled and protesting Lloyd to carry him down again. Temeraire closed his eyes and coiled himself again, with a drip, drip, drip of the icicles his only company. A few hours later, Pasaitia and Monsey landed on the cave ledge with a studied air of insouciance, carrying two fresh-killed cows. They brought them inside, in front of him.
"I am not hungry,"
Temeraire said sharply.
"Oh, we only told Lloyd they was for you, so he would let us have extra," Monsey said cheerfully. "You don't mind if we eat them here?"
And he tore into the first one. Temeraire's tail twitched, entirely without volition, at the hot, juicy smell of the blood, and when Pasaitia nudged the second cow over, he took it in his jaws without really meaning to. Then somehow, in a few swallows, it was gone, and what they had left of the first also. He went down for another, and even a fourth. He did not have to think or feel anything while he ate. A small flock of the littler dragons clustered together on the edge of the feeding grounds, watching him anxiously, and when he looked for another cow, a couple of them rose up to herd one towards him. But none of them spoke to him. When he had finished, he flew for a long distance along the river and settled down to drink only where he might be quite alone again. He felt sore in all his joints, as if he had flown very hard for a long time in sleeting weather. He washed, as well as he could manage alone, and went back to his cave to think. Pasaitia came up to see him with an interesting mathematical problem, but he looked at it and then said,
"No, help me find Monsey. I want to know what has been happening with the war."
"Why, I don't know,"
Monsey said, surprised, when they had tracked him down, lazing in a meadow on the mountainside with some of the other Winchesters and small ferals. They were playing a bit of a game, where they tossed tree branches upon the ground and tried to pick up as many as they could without dropping any.
"It's nothing to do with us, you know. Not here. The Frenchy dragons and their captains are all kept over in Scotland, farther up. Don't be any fighting round here."
"It is to do with us, too," Temeraire said. "This is our territory, all of ours, and the French are trying to take it away. That is as much to do with us as if they were trying to take your cave, and more, because they will take everything else along with your cave."
The little dragons put down their sticks and came nearer to listen, with some interest.
"But what do you want to do?" Monsey said.
The official couriers were crossing the countryside in every direction at all speed, and the afternoon was not yet gone before Monsey and the other Winchesters were able to return, full of all the news which Temeraire could wish. If the numbers reported were perhaps a little inconsistent, that did not matter very much. Napoleon certainly had landed a great many men all near London, and there had not been any great battle yet to throw him off.
"He's all over the coast, and then the fellows say there is this Marshal Davout fellow poking about in Kent, south of London, and another one, Lefebvre, who is already somewhere along this way,"
Monsey said, pointing out the countryside west of the city, and nearest Wales.
"Oh, I know that one. He was at the siege of Danzig,"
Temeraire said.
"I do not think he was so very clever. He did not make a big push to have us out, not until Lien came and took charge of everything. Where is our army?"
"All fallen back about London," Minnow said. "Everyone says there's going to be a big battle there in a couple of weeks, perhaps."
"Then there is not a moment to lose," Temeraire said.
They passed the word for another council meeting, and everyone came promptly. The other big dragons, considerably more respectful now, if Ballista still was patronizing, as she said, "You are upset, of course, and no wonder, but I am sure if you tell them you would like another captain..."
"No,"
Temeraire said, the resonance making his whole body tremble, and looked away while everyone fell quiet. After a moment he was able to continue.
"I am not going to take another captain," he said. "A stranger. I do not need a handler as if I were one of Lloyd's cows. I can fight on my own, and so can any of you."
"But what is there to fight for?" Requiescat said. "Even if the French win, they ain't going to give us any bother. It will only be someone else taking eggs, just as careful."
There was a murmur of agreement, and Monsey added a little plaintively,
"And I thought you were on about how unfair the Admiralty are in not letting us have any liberty."
"I do not mean to say anything for the government at all," Temeraire said, "but this country is our territory as much as it is any man's. It belongs to us all together, and if we only sit here eating cows while Napoleon is trying to take it away, we have no right to complain of anything."
"Well, what's there to complain of, then?" Requiescat said. "We have everything as we like it."
"So you would quarrel over one wet, unpleasant cave instead of another? But you would not like to sleep in a pavilion which is never wet or cold, even in winter," Temeraire said scornfully. "You only think you have things as you like because you have never seen anything better, and that is because you have spent all your lives penned up here or in coverts."
When he had described pavilions for them a little more, and the dragon city in Africa, and added,
"And in Yutien there were dragons who were merchants, and all of them had heaps of jewels. Only tin and glass, Lawrence said, but they were very pretty anyway, and in Africa they had gold enough to put it on all their crews."
There were not many dragons who did not sigh at least a little, and those who had some little bit of treasure on them looked at it, and many of the rest looked at them, wistfully.
"It all sounds a lot of gimcrackery to me," Requiescat said.
"Then you may stay here and have my cave, which is not a quarter as nice as a pavilion," Temeraire said coolly. "And when we have beaten Napoleon and taken prizes, you shan't have a share. Monsey will have more gold than you."
"Prizes?"
Gentius said, rousing unexpectedly.
"I helped in taking a prize once. My captain had a 14th share. That is how she bought the picture."
Everyone knew Gentius's painting, and a really impressed murmur went around. This was better than hypothetical jewels in another country, which none of them had seen.
Now, settle down,"
Ballista said, thumping her tail, but with a considerably more lenient air.
"Look here, I suppose no one much wants the French to beat, anyway. We have all had a go with them before, if we were ever in service, but the men don't want us unless we take harness and captains, and we cannot just go wandering into battles. We will get circled round and shot up. That is no joke, even for us big ones."
"If we fight thoughtlessly, just one alone at a time, we will," Temeraire said. "But there is no reason we must, and we cannot be boarded if we have no harness, or anyone to capture. We will be our own army, and we will work out tactics for ourselves, not stuff men have invented without bothering to ask us, even though they cannot fly themselves. It stands to reason we can do better than that, if we try."
Well, Ballista said.
This was a convincing argument, and the general murmur of agreement found it so.
All right, Requiescat said. Very nice storytelling, but it is all a hum. Treasure and battles are well and good, but what do you mean to do for dinner?"
They landed all together on the grounds the next morning at the feeding time, the cows bellowing invitingly in their pen, and the delicious grassy scent made Temeraire's tongue want to lick out at the air. But the other dragons all kept the line with him. No one even put their nose out towards the running cattle. The herdsmen prodded the cows forward with no results, and looked at one another and back at Lloyd in confusion. Lloyd began going up and down the line, looking up at them all in bafflement, saying to one after another in turn, "Go on, then, eat something," entreatingly. Temeraire waited until Lloyd came up to him and then bent his head down and said,
"Lloyd, where do the cows come from?"
Lloyd stared at him.
"Go on, eat something, old boy," he repeated feebly, so it came out as a question more than a command.
"Stop that. My name is Temeraire, or you may say Sir," Temeraire said, "since that is how to speak to someone politely."
Lloyd said, not very sensibly.
"You have heard that the French have invaded?" Temeraire inquired.
"Oh," Lloyd said in tones of relief, "none of you need worry anything about that. Why, they shan't come anywhere near or interfere with the cows. You shall all be fed. The cows will come here every day. There's no call to save them, old boy."
Temeraire raised his head and gave a small roar, only to quiet him. A bit of snow came tumbling down the slope on the other side of the feeding grounds, but it was not very much. A foot, perhaps, scarcely deep enough to dust his talons.
"You will say, Sir," he told Lloyd, lowering his head to fix Lloyd securely with one eye.
"Sir?"
Lloyd said faintly. Satisfied, Temeraire sat back on his haunches and explained,
"We are not staying here," he said, "so you see it is no help to say the cows will be here. We are going to fight Napoleon, all of us, and we need to take the cows with us."
Lloyd did not seem at first to understand him. It required the better part of an hour to work it into his head that they were all leaving the grounds together and did not mean to come back. And then he began to be desperate, and to beg and plead with them in a very shocking way which made Temeraire feel wretchedly embarrassed. Lloyd was so very small, and it felt bullying to say no to him.
"That is quite enough," Temeraire said at last, forcing himself to firmness. "Lloyd, we are not going to hurt you, or take away your food or your property, so you have no right to go on at us in this way, only because we do not like to stay."
"How you talk! I'll be dismissed my post for sure, and that's the least of it," Lloyd said, almost in tears. "It's as much as my life is worth if I let you all go out wandering wild, pillaging farmers' livestock every which way."
"But we are not going pillaging at all," Temeraire said. "That is why I am asking you where the cows come from. If the government would feed them to us here, they are ours, and there is no reason we cannot take them and eat them somewhere else."
"But they come from all over,"
Lloyd said, and gesturing to his herdsmen added,
"The drovers bring a string every week from another farm. It's as much as all of Wales can do to feed you lot. There's not one place."
"Oh," Temeraire said, and scratched his head.
He had envisioned some very large pen somewhere over the mountains, perhaps, full of cows waiting to be taken out and carried along.
"Well," he decided, "then you all will have to help. You will go to the farms and fetch the cows and bring them along to us, and that way," he added with a burst of fresh inspiration, "no one can complain to you or sack you, because you will not have let us go off at all."
This solution did not immediately promote itself to the herdsmen, who began to protest. Some of them had families, and none of them liked to go to war.
"No, that is all stuff," Temeraire said. "It is your duty to fight the French as much as it is ours, more, because it is your government, and it would press you if you were needed. I have been to sea with many pressed men. I know it is not very nice," he added, although he did not entirely see why they did not like to go. Anywhere was certainly better than this loathsome place, and they would be doing something and not only sitting about. "But if Napoleon wins, that will also not be very nice. And anyway, I dare say the government will stop your wages if they learn you are sitting here with no dragons about. And if you come, we will give you a share of the prizes we take."
Prizes proved a magical word with men as well as dragons, as did the general conviction arrived at among the men through a deal of quiet muttering that if they did not go, they should certainly be blamed. but no one could complain they had not done their duty if they followed the beasts when they ran off. Or at least it would be more difficult to find them to complain.
"We might be ready soon as next week," Lloyd said, one last gasping attempt. "If you'd all just have a bite to eat and a bit of sleep—"
"We are leaving now,"
Temeraire said, and rising up on his haunches called out,
"Advance guard aloft, and you may take your breakfast too."
Monsey and all the small dragons all gleefully leapt onto the herd, first for once, and went up still eating as they flew. It was perhaps a little messy, but much quicker to eat as one went. Minnow swallowed the head of her cow, and waving a wing-tip,
"We will see you at the rendezvous," she called down. "Come on then, Pips, off we go," she said to the other courier waits,
and they all went storming away rapidly northward and east along the planned route.
"Now can we eat?"
Requiescat said, watching after them plaintively.
"Yes, you may all eat, but have half now, and take the rest to eat along the way, because otherwise you will fly slow and be hungry again anyway at the end of it,"
Temeraire said.
"Lloyd, we are going to Abergavenny, or outside it anyway. Do you know where that is?"
"But we can't drive the herd all that way by tomorrow,"
Lloyd said.
"Then you will have to bring them as close as you can, and we will manage somehow,"
Temeraire said. He was done listening to difficulties.
"I have seen Napoleon's army fight, and in a week they will be in London, so we must be also."
"We are 150 miles from London,"
Lloyd protested.
"All the more reason to travel fast," Temeraire said,
and flung himself into the air.
Chapter 5 Lawrence stood bewildered in the empty grounds, and called Temeraire's name a few times. There was no answer but the mumbled echoes that the cliffs gave back, and the momentary attention of a small red squirrel which paused to look at him before continuing on its way. Elsie landed again behind him.
"Not a wing in the sky, sir," Hollin said, "but we found."
Elsie carried them up to a cave, reaching deep into the mountain face. Though the light was failing rapidly, Lawrence could trace with his fingers the letters of Temeraire's name carved deeply into the rock. So at least he had been here, and well enough to leave this mark. They managed to fashion a torch to inspect it, but the cave was too tidy inside to guess when his habitation had ended. No bones or other remnants of food. It was only 2 days since the landing, but with as many dragons as lived in the breeding grounds, if the herdsmen had all abandoned their posts and the regular delivery of cattle had been interrupted, the provisions would quickly have been spent. The dragons must have scattered from hunger, and likely in all the directions of the Rose.
"Well, let us not borrow trouble," Hollin said, consoling. "He is a clever fellow, and it cannot have been so long since they left. There are some fresh bones down by the pen, from this morning by the look of them."
Lawrence shook his head.
"I hope he would not have been so foolish as to stay to the last," he answered low. "So many dragons will undoubtedly be eating up all the local supply as they go, and he must have more food than a smaller beast."
"I am a smaller beast," Elsie said, a little anxiously. "But I must have something to eat too, and there is nothing here."
They went to Lechrud, the nearest settlement they found, and bought her a sheep from a small cottager, who told them the village by some lucky chance had not been raided.
"Flew off east, all of them, at once this morning,"
the old woman told Lawrence, while Elsie discreetly made her dinner out behind the stable.
"Like a plague of crows! It was dark half an hour, all them passing over, and as sure they would fall on us in a moment. More than that I can't say."
"Hollin," Lawrence said, when he had turned away disheartened, "I cannot tell you what your duty is. We have no very good intelligence, I am afraid. And if he is flying to feed himself, we cannot well imagine where he may have gone."
"Well, sir," Hollin said, "they said to bring you back with him, and I suppose those are my orders until I hear otherwise. Anyways, I dare say we will find him tomorrow, first thing, or good as. It's not as though he's so easy to miss."
But this was not reckoning with the confusion of dozens of beasts all flung out upon the countryside at once. Certainly dragons, in the plural, had been seen everywhere, dreadful marauding beasts, and no one knew what things were coming to when they were just allowed to go flying around loose. But as to one particular dragon, black, with a ruff, no one had anything to say. One farmer, 30 miles on, belligerent enough to be brave, had not hidden in his cellar during the visitation, and swore that a giant dragon had eaten 4 of his cows, informing him they were being confiscated for the war effort, and he should be repaid by the government. He even showed them where the dragon had scratched a mark in an old oak tree for his reimbursement. And for a moment Lawrence entertained hopes. But it was not a Chinese mark, only an X, clumsily carved through the bark with 4 scratches below.
"Red and yellow like fire,"
the oldest boy said, peering at them from over the window-sill of the house, despite his mother's restraining hand, and sank them completely. 10 dragons had stopped to drink at the lake on the grounds of a stately house in Monmouthshire, the housekeeper told them, anxiously, and eaten some of the deer. 10 neat X's were marked in the dirt by the lake shore.
"I am sure I could not tell you if they were black or red or spotted green and yellow. It was all I had to do to keep breathing with half my maids fainted dead away," she said. "And then one of the creatures came to the door and asked us through it if we had any curtains. Red ones," she added. "We threw outside all the ones from the ballroom, and then they took them and went away."
Lawrence was baffled. Curtains? He would have understood better if they had demanded the silver plate. But at least they were moving in a group, and in the earnest excuses for the pillaging he thought he saw Temeraire's influence, if not his presence. It was so near a mimic to the Chinese mode which they had witnessed, where dragons purchased goods by making their mark for the supplier. The following day they discovered another farmer with a collection of marks, who, rather astonishingly, was not unhappy. "The dragons had eaten 4 of his cows yesterday," he agreed. "But that very morning some men had come through with a string of cattle and given him replacements, which he pointed out in their field. 4 handsome beef cattle, better in all honesty than the scrawnier animals in the farmer's own herd." 7 dragons had been seen in Penycloth. 4 had landed by the river in Llandogo, and perhaps one of them had been black. Yes, certainly one had been black. Then 12 had been seen. No, 24. No, 100. Numbers shouted by the crowd in the common room of an inn, growing steadily more implausible. Lawrence gave it no credit at all, but a few miles farther along, Elsie landed them in a torn-up meadow, with a neatly dug necessary pit on the low side away from the water, filled in but still fragrant, with signs of occupation by at least some number of dragons.
"We must be getting right close, then," Holland said encouragingly.
But the next day no one had so much as seen a wing-tip, though Elsie went miles around in widening rings to make inquiries for hours and hours together. They had one and all vanished into the air.
"We will be getting close to the French tomorrow, so beginning today we will fly when it is dark," Temeraire said, "and try and be as quiet as we can. So pass the word to everyone not to fly somewhere if you see lights or if you smell cows, because they will bellow and run and make a fuss."
The others nodded, and Temeraire rose up on his haunches to inspect their own pen of cattle. He missed Gong Su very much. It was not that cooked food was so much pleasanter, he did not care about the taste at all at present, but Gong Su could stretch a single cow amongst 5 hungry dragons, if only there were rice, or something else like to cook it with. The farther they got from Wales, the more complicated everything became. Lloyd said that it was expensive to bring the cows so far, because they must be fed along the road, and they could not be brought very quickly, because they would sicken and stop being fat and good to eat. It helped a great deal that Magistratus had suggested the notion of borrowing cows in advance, and using the later ones to repay. But if they were always flying about, snatching cows from the nearby farms, the French were sure to hear about it. Marshal Lefebvre's forces were busy snatching cows themselves.
"Maybe we oughtn't be having the cows driven to us," Monsey said. "We could always go fetch them for ourselves and come back." "That is no good at all," Pasitia said severely. "The longer we must fly to get to the supply, the more food we must eat only to reach there and come back, which is a waste, and also it means more time flying back and forth instead of fighting."
"Supply lines," Gentius said dolefully, shaking his head. "War is all about supply lines. My 3rd captain told me."
He had insisted on coming along, although he could not really see very well to fly any more, and tired easily. But he was grown light enough that he could be carried along by any of the heavyweights, and it was very satisfying to everyone to think they had a long wing with them. Aside from the difficulty about the food, Temeraire was pleased with their progress. He and Persaetia had devised several manoeuvres which even Ballista had allowed to be clever, and Monsey and the others had brought them a good deal of news about the French, although they could only sneak so close before it became too likely they should be caught. Temeraire was trying to think how they might better find a way to spy. They had worked out how to organise their camp so it did not take a great deal of room, by letting the smaller dragons sleep atop the big, which was warmer anyway, and after the first awkward day had learned to dig their necessary pit far away from their water. That had been very unpleasant, and five of the dragons had got quite sick from being so thirsty they had drunk anyway, despite the smell. A few others had grown bored and gone off on their own, all of them ferals who had never served. But some of those had come back when they had not been able to find easy food on their own, which brought them straight back to the question of supply.
"We can go and fetch a great many cattle here if they are drugged with laudanum," Temeraire said. "But it seems to me, if the French are going about taking cows, we would do better to eat their food first instead of our own, and let them have the bother of gathering it. And that way we may fight and eat together."
It made a sensible strategy, they all agreed, and for Temeraire it was nearly more justification than cause. He wanted badly to fight. The urge to violence, not particular but general, hunger for some explosive action, was always stirring in him now, craving release, and Persaetia and Monsey often eyed him anxiously. Sometimes Temeraire would even rouse up, not from sleep but from some halfway condition, and find himself deserted. The others all flown away some distance, crouched down low and watching him.
"It isn't healthy how he pens it up," Gentius said loudly after their meeting, not seeing Temeraire close enough to overhear. "You fellows don't know what it is like, having a really fine captain and losing her. It is worse than having all your treasure stolen. That is why he goes so queer now and again. A proper battle, that is what he needs, a bit of blood."
And Temeraire wanted it very much. He did not like the sensation of being a passenger, it seemed to him, in his own life, unable not to feel as he chose, and if a battle would repair it, he was almost tempted to go seek one out at once. But he had brought everyone else along. He could not abandon them to their own devices now, or drag them into a mindless squabble, even if he would have liked one. Instead, he brooded on strategy, and when the urge grew more difficult to bear, he went away and curled himself tightly with his head against his flank, beneath the dark huddle of his wing, and murmured to himself from the Principia Mathematica, which Lawrence had read to him so often he had it all by heart, and if he spoke low and flattened his voice, he might almost imagine he heard Lawrence instead, reading to him in the rain, safe and sheltered beside him. But he need not have struggled so hard to keep it in. The very next morning Minnow and Reedley came into camp flying so quick they had to skip-hop a few paces along the ground to stop, full of news.
"Pigs!" Reedley said, panting. "So many of them! A whole pen back of their army, and some of them are big as ponies!"
"Pigs," Gentius said thoughtfully, cracking an eye. "Pigs are good eating all the way through."
"Pigs are easy to keep," Lloyd put in. "We drive them into the forest, and they will feed themselves, and you go in and take one when you want, or round them up to drive them along." "And there are only a couple of old chevaliers to guard them," Minnow said. "They are big but lazy, and they were fast asleep when we saw."
"Very good," Temeraire said, attempting to sound cool and serene, although his tail wanted to thump the ground in an undignified way. "Lloyd, you and your men will go with Monsey and the Winchesters. You will wait until we have attacked and drawn everyone off, and then you will go and take the pigs and bring them along here." "Now," he said, turning, and swept a patch of dirt smooth with the tip of his tail. "Minnow, show me what the camp looks like."
They set off a couple of hours before evening. Minnow and Reedley were very sure there was not a fleur de nuit with the company, and so they would attack at night, when everyone would be asleep and most surprised, and have the most difficulty in chasing after them when the pigs had been seized. The little dragons would come behind, that much was decided, and Temeraire, after some thinking, put one of their checkered nettles, Armatius, in front, carrying Gentius upon his back. Ballista and Magistatus went on either side of him, and Requiescat came behind them, and to either side of him a couple of yellow reapers carrying their flags. These were not very elegant, only some velvet curtains tied up to saplings, but every real army had flags, and red was an auspicious colour. Streaming out,
they made a fine show, especially carried by the yellow reapers to either side of Requiescat's orange and red. Everyone brightened as they billowed out, and the reapers were especially pleased and held themselves proudly. Even Requiescat turned his head as they flew and said,
"Well, those are something like, anyway,"
to Temeraire, who only inclined his head stiffly. He did not, by then, trust himself to speak. They came near the camp, with the sun already down behind them, and small cooking fires lit all over among the tents.
"Gentius," Temeraire said, "when I roar, you will go in first. Only show them your wings, and spit somewhere near the guns, and then fly back to Amatius, and go back to camp. You cannot see well enough to be spitting once we have flown in, but they will not know that, and I dare say it will make them very alarmed."
"Ha-ha!" Gentius said. "Fighting again at my age! I feel like a hatchling!"
And he fluttered out his wings a little, making ready. Temeraire broke away and flew ahead towards the camp, climbing as he did, and hovered directly above it. The moon had not yet risen, and he did not think they would notice him. It was very peculiar to be so close to the enemy but not fighting yet, to start a battle when he chose, and not wholly comfortable. It had always seemed so very plain to him and quite natural when one should dart in and begin, but that was when he only needed to think of himself. Now there were so many others to consider, and the enemy too. Perhaps, it occurred to him suddenly, there were a great many other French dragons nearby, which they had not seen or heard of, who would appear out of nowhere and turn the tide. Then they should lose, and it would be his fault. He should have lost the day. The prospect was alarming, as no ordinary fighting would have been, and Temeraire almost thought perhaps he would go back and ask the others what they thought. He looked back northwest. He could just make them out, a great mass of shadows darker than the trees and the fields below. They were coming on as slowly as they could, wingbeats lazy so they drifted low, and then swooped back up, describing great arcs instead of flying straight, all of them waiting for his signal. If only he might have a little advice. But he was quite alone. He trembled, but there was no use being cowardly. There was no one to help him, and he must decide. Below, the two chevaliers slept just one hill beyond the low, rough earthwork barricade, where the sentries strolled along the line casually. In the camp, fires were scattered about and some horses. The wind drifted a little, bringing some eddy with it, and one of the horses raised its head and whickered uneasily. Another pawed at the ground and tossed its head.
"Ce n'est rien, ce n'est rien," a man said, eating his supper near them.